And he smiled and said, if I need a scientist, I can hire a scientist. I need a lawyer who understands the law of conspiracy. I said, well, I understand law of conspiracy. That's not a challenge. And so I got hired, and the thing that really was very attractive was the government was paying me $10,000 a year. You could depart up the ante to 12. And I said to myself, well, you know, $2,000 is $2,000, but there's even the chance that there might be more money later. Who knows? So I took the opportunity. My problem at that moment was they wanted an antitrust lawyer. You know, I had never read the Sherman Act. I was a criminal lawyer. And so I bought an antitrust casebook and holed up in the hotel room for 6 weeks and just worked my way through the book and then pronounced myself an antitrust expert. And it works.
Was, before you accepted the job at DuPont, did you come to Wilmington and interview with the legal department?
Oh, yes.
Was there any concern about your being a Jew in terms of joining that department?
There turned out to be. The first round was one in which the general counsel recommended the appointment, and someone on the executive committee of the company responsible for personnel refused to approve the appointment, and so it fell to my friend to come see me in Washington and tell me the sorry tale, and it was a crushing blow. But now that's life. So, you know, I would go on living, really a year or two later, when he came back and said, you know, now I can guarantee it can be done. Please say you'll do it. And it turned out that the VP that had been the culprit had retired, and his replacement. So the only question I've got is, this guy is as good as you say he is. Maybe we ought to try to keep him in Washington. But in any event, I came in, the thing that made it workable for me was that with my name, there was no mystery at all. And lo and behold, nobody paid any attention. I found a setting in which there were a handful of Jewish lawyers who had been there for years, but they were all anonymous. They made their charitable gifts anonymously. They didn't admit their background. The point of this is not that so much, but rather Corporate Greenwald had become chairman of the company. And someone got to him and said, do you realize what's going on in your company? There's a sense out there that the company is hostile to Jewish people. And I have to say in all candor that the largest business DuPont had was the textile fibers business. And Jewish people were all over that business and were major customers. And so Crawford stepped up to it, and he wrote a letter for quiet publication that disavowed the past and proclaimed a new era for the future. And it turned out to be true. I think that Crawford simply never thought in terms like that. I think the DuPont brothers did. But in any event, there I was. And it happens in life sometimes. One of the early people to become an admirer of me was Walter Carpenter, who had been the CEO prior to Crawford Greenwald. And this was a fascinating experience because he was a very sophisticated, bright, knowledgeable person. And he was addressed as Mr. Carpenter by everybody, the top command. And he got into sort of a little game with me. He knew the legal department started at 8:30 in the morning, so at 8 o'clock he'd leave a call for me. And then he got in the habit of wanting to hear a discussion of Supreme Court decisions. Decisions came out on Monday and Tuesday morning. He was on the phone telling me what this case means and why. And so we developed a relationship. And finally, one morning, he said, Mr. Shapiro, my name is Walter. I said, well, in those circumstances, you can call me Irv. And we became, you know, very good friends on a business basis. And he had great respect for me. And I'm sure it made a difference in how others saw me. But that was the beginning of the brood up. I'm not sure he triggered it, but I'm sure that when people mentioned my name, said, what do you think? And he said, yeah, this guy's all right. And that was the beginning of unforeseeable all right.
Carpenter, if I remember correctly, had married one of the DuPonts, is that correct?
Yes, yes. No, that's not correct. His brother had.
Oh, okay.
Carpenter had not. Carpenter had married a woman who had been working for one of the DuPont families. But his brother, Rudy Carpenter, had been tied to Pierre DuPont. And Rudy married one of Pierre's sisters.
When did you first meet some of the DuPonts? Was it through Walter Carpenter that you met others?
No. My relationship with Walter Carpenter was one-on-one, and never went beyond that. After I was in the saddle for a while, I found myself assigned to the what we called the General Motors litigation with the antitrust case in Chicago to force DuPont to get out of its investment in General Motors. And we had a big team in Chicago. And part of my assignment was to stay back in Wilmington and make sure that the top management of the company knew on a daily basis what was happening and understood the significance of it, pro or con. And I drew that straw for a while. I went out to Chicago later, but in any event, every day I met with the key people on the executive committee and gave them a rundown of the previous day's developments. And they began to feel free to call me when they had anything on their mind. Before long, they saw me as their lawyer, and when we won in Chicago, they had all rubbed off. I thought they had a pretty good horse, and when we were through with the case, I represented various of the industrial departments and had a curious experience. My function in life was to solve their problems. And very often they come in with a proposed course of action that clearly was illegal. And say, well, you know, if you've got this kind of a problem, you can't do it this way, but let's think about alternative courses of action. And maybe you can't get 100% of what you're after, but can you live with 70%, 80%? And usually I gave them two or three alternatives of action, and they'd select one, and it worked. And so pretty soon the word went out that this guy is different from all the other lawyers. Then I found myself being invited to sit in on the staff meetings of the industrial department heads whose legal work I did, which was a signal to their people that this guy was okay. And after a while, it was an accepted fact that you get a call from one of the business people saying, I got a legal problem. You come down, you didn't have a legal problem at all. He had a business problem, and he was looking for help. And I discovered that somehow or other, I had some business judgment that I could apply, and it helped him solve his problem. And finally, the manager just said, you're now functioning as a businessman anyhow. Why don't you stop pretending you're a lawyer, come on over to the business side of things. And so at that point I was an assistant general counsel of the DuPont, and I got jumped four or five grades, I guess, and made a vice president of the company and member of the executive committee. And that was significant for two reasons. The first was that it had never before happened to a lawyer in DuPont. And secondly, no one in the history of the company had jumped that far in one step. And there were people who had concerns about whether I was ready for something like that, and I was one of them. But I figured you can't say no to an opportunity like that. You've got to give it a shot and see if you can make it work. And so I came on the committee, and didn't take long to get convinced that these are all great fellas, but they also put their trousers on one leg at a time, and they didn't know any better answers than I knew. And so it got to the point where I had built up a following as a guy who could solve the tough problems. And then the rest of the story, you know. At one point, I was simply told that if I would take it, I was going to succeed Ralph McCoy as CEO of the company. And that was so far from anything I'd ever thought of that I asked for a tablet and a pen, and I want to write this down so I can get it right. And there it was. And once I took over, it seemed to me the job is pretty well defined. I didn't have to be a scientist to do the job. I had to be a fellow who understood the people and had the support of the people in the organization, who understood the political scene on the outside, the press scene and all the rest, and who had some ideas about direction. And somehow it all came together and worked. I think in part it worked because DuPont had been a very closed-in company. While the family ran it, secrecy was a word, and they didn't want the press anywhere near them and all the rest. And the world had changed, and my view of the world was that the press could be our ally if we did it the right way. And I made it a point, always talking to reporters directly, never turning them down, and never lying to them. If something came up that I couldn't talk about, I told them, I can't talk to you now about this, but when it opens up and I can, I'll talk to you. And I established my credibility, both in government circles and with the press, and that made an enormous difference. Once you open the windows and let some fresh air in, all kinds of things changed. And then kept that up, the business roundtable, draft, I mean, I had the business roundtable, and that was still in its fledgling days, but it was inconceivable to anybody who tried to rationalize it. A guy named Shapiro would become the spokesman for all of American industry, and they would listen. But they did, and it all worked. And so the one great dividend out of that that sort of gets lost in the shuffle, but which is important, is that if it was good enough for DuPont, it was suddenly good enough every place else. And within a couple of years, I could give you a list of 300 Jewish men who were in the top circles of American corporations. And today, it's not even a newsworthy event. And so, you know, in a quiet, simplistic way, a great thing was accomplished, totally apart from running the business.
Could I go back to some of the early days in the legal department? You said you had done some things before you were assigned to the antitrust case, is that correct? Or when you first went there,
well,
right on that case?
No, I came in and functioned as an antitrust lawyer and wrote opinions. For example, there was a question about whether DuPont's position on nylon was monopolistic. And so I did an elaborate study of nylon and concluded that there was not a monopoly, an illegal monopoly. And I ought to relax about that. There were other assignments like that, and then the system changed, and each industrial department was given a lawyer as its lawyer, and I drew a couple of interesting departments, and one of them invited me to speak at its sales meeting, and I thought about it. I finally hit on a theme, and the theme was this: Louis Brandeis, when he practiced law in Boston, represented a lot of major power companies, and he had a session with his clients, and the nuts of it was, gentlemen, if you insist on walking along the edge of a precipice, I can't tell you when you'll fall off, but I can tell you you will fall off. On the other hand, if you'll tell me what your objectives are, perhaps I can find a different route that will solve your problem with no risk of falling off the precipice. Well, that was a marvelous experience, and so I addressed this gung-ho sales group and said, you fellas have an image of a lawyer as a guy who learned to say no to you. It's not constructive. And I want to tell you, I'm a different kind of lawyer. And I went through the Brandeis thing and said, that's how I feel. If you'll tell me what you're up to, I can help you solve your problems. But if you keep me in the dark, I can't be of much use to you. Next thing that happened was the head of the department was getting in touch with the general counsel saying, you finally got a lawyer in your place. And that was the start of it. I worked closely with the clients. I attended the staff meetings. I conducted sample surveys and what went on in their files. Attended all the sales meeting, that sort of thing, and built the relationship with the people. And as they moved up in the business, they remembered who I was. And so, you know, it was that kind of thing before, well, I guess early on I was involved briefly in the cellophane monopoly litigation as well. But the big thing came with the General Motors case in Chicago.
It's my understanding that you were you directed the final settlement in terms of the divestiture not being counted as capital gains as opposed to regular income as a stockholder.
As more than just I, we undertook a campaign to convince the Congress that it was prohibited to tax our stockholders on an ordinary income basis on a forced divestiture. And this was a struggle for several years. And our real problem, it turned out, that we had a Senator John Williams here in Delaware who was setting up the roadblocks. The rest of the Senate leadership was ready to move on. And I can't be sure, but I think Senator Williams, who came from downstate Delaware, just wanted a socket to the DuPont family. He didn't care about the other stockholders. And so we finally worked out a plan in which the family people paid a tax on receipt of the stock, and all the other stockholders simply got it and reduced the cost basis for their DuPont stock. And so Williams got his pound of flesh, and turned out not to be that painful for the family, because that gave for even to move the stock without tax consequences later. So they paid taxes sooner. The state of Delaware wound up with a huge fund that came from the taxes the state got on this, and we managed to create a reserve fund to be used for important unforeseen developments in the state. And that lasted a few years. The politician got through that. But in any event, the problem was to not penalize the routine stockholder for this. The fact was that the DuPont family had prospered very well on the General Motors investment, and paying the tax was not the worst thing in the world. But it wasn't the same for the average stockholder. He may have bought a stock 2 weeks ago, and sock him with taxes at that point was brutal. So we got it worked out.
What was your relationship with Crawford Greenwald? What kind of person was he to work with?
Well, it started in a setting in which I was much closer to Walter Carpenter, and known Crawford, but not really close to him at all. And occasionally I'd get called in on some problem, and I'd give him advice, and almost always say no. And all right, my function in life was to give the advice, not to impose it on anybody. And then I began to notice that some months later, after he thought about it for a while, his views changed, and he started implementing the things that I had urged. And I never said anything to him about that. He never said anything to me about it. But we obviously both understood what was happening. And so, from my standpoint, it was an educational process. And gradually, obviously, we became much closer, but in a formal kind of a way. And it wasn't until Merle McCoy took over that I really blossomed on DuPont's ninth floor. And in between that, you had Lamont DuPont Copeland. But McCoy really didn't know me very well, but he knew me by reputation. And he took a shine to me. And then a peculiar thing happened, and these are the kind of thing that you can never plan ahead of time. Ralph Nader used to have teams of college kids himself sending them to investigate a company for a summer. And one year, he was going to do it with Citicor and with DuPont. Ralph McCoy was on the Citicor board, became a big issue there, and they brought in their law firm, laws and memoranda, and finally a great plan was produced. And DuPont had played differently, and McCoy called me and said, we're going to have to face this. You better be the guy who runs it and tell me how you plan to do it. And quite innocently, I sat down, figured out a plan of action, presented it to him. And he said, my goodness, this is exactly the plan that this great law firm in New York presented to city court. And I said, well, not surprising. Good lawyers are going to think the same way. But in any event, that fixed it in his mind. He had one man who was the equivalent of this team of great lawyers in New York. And so we fought that battle quite successfully. And by then, I was on the executive committee. And then he looked to me for an objective judgment. He knew I had no irons in the fire. That, as a matter of fact, it didn't ever occur to me that I was a candidate for anything more. As a matter of fact, I wasn't quite sure why I got on the committee. But at least I made myself useful on the committee in some constructive ways. And McCoy, with the concurrence of Greenwald and Carpenter, decided I was the guy to succeed him. There was no one more surprised than I.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the Nader case?
Well, sure. The Nader affair was the typical case in which you arrive at a judgment first and then you look for facts to justify your judgment. And they picked a half a dozen kids and they took up residence in Wilmington for the summer. And they wanted to examine all kinds of DuPont files and all kinds of DuPont people. And indeed, they did it in the surrounding area too. But the conditions I laid down for interviews was simply, we would set a schedule and we would record the interviews so there'd be a record. They gave us the names they wanted. And I produced those people, made a record of it. They objected vigorously that this was an interference with free speech to record what people said. And go away, you know, waste our time. They were innocent kids, mostly. There were one or two that simply had a lot of baggage to carry, but it was a lark for them. They went around the barber shop, for example, and asked the barber whether I tipped decently and things like that. The whole town rallied around us, and wherever they went, all they got was positive information, even if they had to stretch things a little bit. And so they wound up writing a report that was obviously negative, but was intended to be negative from the beginning. And what we did was, McCoy and I sat down and said, well, there's no way we can deal with this by just saying we disagree with them. Let's go through this material and find some gross errors and put out an error sheet immediately. That urges anybody who reads that report